Dr. John Abramson has a lot to say about how the drug companies are systematically misinforming you, your doctors, about the best medical care. The really scary part of this is that Dr. Abramson is not an uninformed outsider. He's inside. He's disciplined. He's a researcher. He's on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School. He says that the American people are not just taken advantage of financially by the healthcare system. At the same time, their health is being sacrificed to increase corporate profits, probably more so now than ever. Dr. Abramson also serves as an expert for plaintiff's attorneys in litigation involving the pharmaceutical industry, author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promises of American Medicine. Back with us now on Coast to Coast AM. John, how are you, Doc?
I'm fine, George, and thanks for having me back.
Likewise.
There's so much to talk about. There's so much important stuff going on.
You know, things don't change. I know you were with me some time ago and you were with Ian. And, you know, the commercialization of American medicine continues to affect all of us, doesn't it?
Absolutely, George. And the reason why things don't change is because the politicians and the doctors and the discourse in the United States never gets to the bottom of the problem. But the real core of the issue, George, is that our healthcare system is run to generate the maximum profits that can be generated for the drug industry and the insurance industry and the hospital industry. And it's like a profit-making opportunity. And the American people and most doctors believe that the mission of our healthcare system ought to be to make us healthy most effectively and efficiently. But that's not what's going on.
It is. It's all about money. It's all about shareholder value. Now, with the situation that we're in now, John, with I will call the economic calamity, we've seen what has happened to the price of gasoline at the pump. Profits there are being eroded. It's about time, by the way. They've made enough. What's happening at the pharmaceutical level? Are the price of drugs going down at all? What's happening there?
The price is not going down. And in fact, if you've been watching your TV at all, you've been seeing advertisements from the pharmaceutical industry, from pharma, the trade organization, showing the bus going around the country saying, look, if you need prescription drugs, we'll give them to you for free if you can't afford them. And the reason why they're doing that, George, is because they're pretty confident that insurance coverage is going to be expanded and that the insurance will be paying full retail price for their drugs. And things are looking very good in the drug industry right now.
You know, as you know, John, I'm a healthcare nut, and I'm a natural person first and foremost. You know, number one, I don't take vaccines. If anybody does want to take vaccines, that's between their doctor and themselves. That's their call, their decision. I'm just telling people about what I do. And I try to do things naturally as much as I can. Of course, every once in a while, I've taken, antibiotics and things like that. Used to have some high blood pressure. But, you know, by and large, I try to do everything with weight and in a natural way. There are some drugs out there on the market, John, that I'm sure help people and help people quite a bit, right?
Absolutely. And it's very important as we get into these stories about the drugs that are being oversold and where the science is being distorted to remember that there are very important drugs. For example, for blood pressure, there are drugs that reduce your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke or kidney failure. Those drugs happen to be the best of those drugs, happens to be the least expensive, hydrochlorothiazide. Sometimes it costs less than the bottle that it's put in. And the publicly funded study that looked at this showed that this is the drug that does the best job at preventing the complications. And yet, unfortunately, because the other drugs are being advertised and the salesmen are coming into the doctor's office and bringing lunch and sending the doctors to continuing education and so forth, the docs aren't paying attention to the science. It's getting drowned out by the commercial version of treat your patients with hypertension with these expensive drugs, not the least expensive drug, which happens to be the best at protecting patients.
And when you say being drowned out by the salesperson and not the science, it's the salesperson generally who will come to the doctor's office and try to educate them and sell them on the drug. Why isn't the American Medical Association, if they're not doing this, getting this information on drugs, pro or con, to the doctors before the marketeer gets there?
It's not their job, George, and they have relationships with the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, they sell data to the drug industry, so when the drug rep comes in to call on your doctor, that drug rep knows exactly what your doctor prescribes, not to whom the prescriptions are going, but which drugs your doctor is prescribing, so the drug salesman can actually be more effective. So the problem is that that's not It should be, I agree with you, it should be the American Medical Association's job to try to ensure that doctors get the best science and practice the best medicine. But that's not what they see their job as, and that's not what the professional societies see their job as. I think we're going to talk today about lowering cholesterol in children and the endorsement of the American Academy of Pediatrics, one of the most trusted professional organizations, and you can see that there's enormous drug company sponsorship. So wherever information has economic value, the drug companies and the other medical industries are there to get their version of the story out.
Here's the other thing, too, that is frustrating, John. Studies will come out. One says this drug is good, use it. Another study comes out, says this drug is not good, don't use it. Same drug. And then all of a sudden we get studies on natural supplements that this stuff works for you or it doesn't. What do you believe?
It's very hard to know, and it's hard for two reasons. First of all, what we can know is that 85% of the clinical trials that evaluate whether a drug works or not are funded by the drug's sponsor. And in those commercially sponsored trials, the odds are five times greater that, guess what, the trial will show that the sponsor's drug is the treatment of choice. And there was one nice study that came out, George, of psychiatric drugs that showed that 90% of the time when you test one psychiatric drug against another, the sponsor's drug wins. So it's like an Escher sketching where all the stairs are going up and down at the same time. You know, the sponsor's drug wins. That's one problem. So what we're getting largely, what we doctors are taught as the scientific evidence that's published in our best medical journals, the odds are five times greater that the commercially sponsored product will be the drug of choice, so-called.
Isn't the study sometimes sponsored by that drug company?
85% of the time. That's the problem. 85% of the clinical trials are sponsored by the drug companies, and 97% of the most influential trials, the ones that are cited, the ones that doctors refer to, are sponsored by the makers of those drugs. So it's infomercials. And the purpose of that research is to maximize the return on investment for the drug company that paid for the research. It's very simple. The Wall Street Journal understands this very well.
What's happening in the world of the FDA and approval, non-approval of drugs?
The FDA is kind of in a holding pattern right now. We see some signs of life. Some of the conflicts of interest are getting wrung out of the FDA. But the FDA has been, it's hard to believe, but the division of the FDA that approves new drugs and oversees drug safety is more than 50% paid for directly by the drug industry. And many, in anonymous surveys, many of the FDA officers say that they see their primary client as the drug industry and not the American people.
And isn't it also true, John, that some of the attorneys who may have worked for some of the pharmaceutical companies end up being staff attorneys for the FDA and maybe sometimes vice versa?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's much worse than that, George. When President Bush took office in 2000, there was not a director of the FDA. He appointed as chief counsel an attorney whose claim to fame had been suing the FDA and restricting the FDA's power, became the chief counsel. And the first thing that Daniel Troy did when he came into office, or not the first thing, but one of the first things, and the most important first thing that Daniel Troy did when he came into office, was put in a delay so that when companies were found to be in violation of FDA rules, when they were marketing their drugs beyond what the drugs, what the FDA said the drugs really did. Daniel Troy put in a delay, so all those warning letters had to go through his office, and it put a month-long delay in warning the drug makers that they had to stop the illegal activity so that the marketing could go on that much longer and that many more hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of drugs could be sold.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You yeah. should have heard my show a couple months ago, John, on aspartame, you know, and how that got approved and how that got pushed onto society. Absolutely incredible.
Was that that story involves George Rumsfeld, doesn't it?
Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's an interesting story. There's another part to this, George, though. We only got to half of it. When you say, why don't the doctors know what to do? Half of it is that the vast majority of the articles they read are commercially sponsored. But the other half, which is much more important, is what I see in my work with the litigation against the drug industry, is that so often negative studies are never published. They're never published. They're invisible. The doctors can't see them. The drug companies cover them up. And I can read you corporate emails that have been unsealed that are just stunning. And what happens is, the docs have no idea. Nobody can have any idea because it's invisible. You can't see it. You need a subpoena to understand the truth of science. That's the problem.
And I believe, John, that most doctors, a tremendous percent of doctors, truly want to help their patients, truly care about their patients. They, you know, find out about a new drug that they think is a wonder drug, and they want to prescribe it because they really want to help the patient. What they don't do is take a step farther to find out that maybe that drug doesn't work, huh?
Absolutely. I agree with everything you said, George. I think the vast majority of doctors totally want to help their patients. The sin is that they don't understand that they're being bamboozled and the information isn't available to them.
John, we'll be back in a moment. We'll talk about these statins for children when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. John Abramson. John, I'm confused about cholesterol. Some tell us, of course, high cholesterol is no good for us. We'll get heart attacks and clogged arteries and everything else. And then they say if cholesterol's too low, it's not good for us. Things will happen to us as well. What do we do?
What do we do? That's a great question, George. And I think it goes back to what you said at the beginning of the show. Your approach is, whenever possible, to take a natural approach, to have confidence that Mother Nature planned for us to be healthy most of the time when we eat a healthy diet, don't smoke, drink in moderation. That's what we need to do. And we need to understand that drugs are beneficial sometimes for people who have heart disease, for people who have diabetes. Cholesterol-lowering drugs are probably beneficial, mm-hmm. and I would recommend them. I'm not anti-drug. But the job of the drug companies is to expand the use of its drugs as far as you can go. And what we see in the adult treatment guidelines for cholesterol is that they're dominated by people who have relationships with the drug companies. They claim to be evidence-based, but they're not, and they frankly lie about the evidence, and they say they lie about the evidence. So if you're confused, don't feel bad, because the doctors are confused because they don't have access to good information either. So let me tell you what the bottom line is from all the research that we know. For men who are these are people who don't have heart disease. For people who do have heart disease, you should probably be taking a cholesterol-lowering statin drug. But understand that eating a healthy diet is three times more important. It won't lower your cholesterol, but it'll reduce your risk of heart disease three times more effectively, as will exercising.
Or maybe do it all if you have a heart problem.
Absolutely do it all. That's what I'm saying, is do it all. And understand that everybody thinks you have a heart problem, you should take a statin. That's correct. Three times more important exercise. Three times more important eat a healthy diet. And remember, those things may not bring your cholesterol level down, but it's not your cholesterol level that's the ultimate determinant of your risk. It's whether you're doing those things. And what you want to do is the things that will provide the medical outcomes that you're seeking. So having a lower cholesterol isn't a medical outcome. We hope that it's a path to a lower risk, but the truth is that's not always the path, and that's why it's so confusing. Now, for people who don't have heart disease, Let's talk about men under 65, women under 65, and people over 65. For men under 65 at very high risk of heart disease who don't have it, there is some benefit to taking a cholesterol-lowering drug. And this study comes was done in west of Scotland, where the risk of dying of heart disease is the highest in the world. And men who have very high bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, 192, and 44% smoke, and 16% already have evidence of vascular disease.
So their diet, John, must be horrible out there.
It's I think they're eating lamb fat all day long.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, if you take those folks and you randomize them, and you put half of them on a statin and half of them on a sugar pill, you do reduce the risk of heart disease by about 31%, and that's a good thing. But here's the kicker. You never hear this, and your doctor rarely hears this. When you look at the real numbers, you've got to treat 50 men like that for 5 years in order to benefit one. So the other 49 men are not going to get any benefit whatsoever from the drug and be at risk of side effects. Now, most doctors...
And again, this is for people with no evidence of heart disease.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. That's a gray zone. And most doctors, I think, would treat that man if the guy understood what the odds were and said, "Doc, this is too much for me. You make the decision." I think most doctors would recommend a statin because they don't want to be taking care of the 50th man when he has a heart attack. You can't spot him. But you got to treat 50 guys for 5 years. Now, when we get over to women under 65, the guidelines that doctors really have to follow say that there are 7 studies that show that statins are beneficial for women who don't have heart disease. And they cite the 7 studies, and not one of those 7 studies shows that. And in the back of the 284-page document, the cholesterol guidelines, it's unbelievable, George, but it says special considerations for women with elevated cholesterol. It says clinical evidence to support these recommendations is generally lacking, which means they were lying. They're acknowledging they're lying. And the recommendations are based on data from men. And you can't do that. Women are different than men. Now, I had an article published in The Lancet with a wonderful drug researcher from the University of British Columbia, and we showed that the guidelines were actually lying.
Jeez.
And we thought that that would change medical care. The Lancet is one of the most prestigious journals in the world. It's published in Great Britain. It's very highly respected, and it didn't have any impact whatsoever. No impact whatsoever. The news that is not commercially advantageous, you think science is science and it's impartial. But when you're going against the commercial current, it's real hard to swim upstream.
What about cholesterol that is too low? That's a problem too, isn't it?
Well, it's complicated.
I've heard you could get an increased risk, for example, of stroke and other problems.
Yes.
If it's too low.
Yes, there are. If you do observational studies and you look at people with very low cholesterol, you do see an increase in certain diseases, cancer, stroke, and so forth. But the problem is that you don't know that those people weren't sick and they have a low cholesterol because they were sick but not diagnosed. So it's confusing. But when you get to over age 65 or 70, the higher your cholesterol is, the longer you live.
Huh.
But it's important to remember.
If you can get that far.
Well, you got to get that far, but yeah. It's not your cholesterol level. It's whether you're exercising and eating a healthy diet. That's the key.
The big danger, is it not, John, is those arteries and the plaque that attaches itself to the arteries, whether it's just the hardening of calcium. Did a program with Douglas Mulhall, who has written a book about calcification in the arteries,
mm-hmm.
And his theory is that nanobacteria breaks down after you try to get away from the calcification. So they're recommending antibiotic treatment with everything that you're trying to do. But isn't the plaque in the arteries one of the major problems?
Yeah. What happens is the way this unfolds is that bad cholesterol particles, LDL particles, migrate through the wall of the artery, and they create an inflammatory response in the wall of the artery itself. That inflammatory response brings in these cells that lay down this debris that turns into plaque. And then as plaque grows, we used to think that heart attacks came because the plaque built up so much that it blocked the artery, no blood got through, and you had a heart attack. But that's not really how it happens. What happens is plaque builds up, and then for reasons that are unclear, the plaque ruptures. And when it ruptures, it creates a platelet thrombus. The platelets try and stop the bleeding around the rupture of the plaque, and that's what causes an acute heart attack. Now, a lot of the information that leads to the theory that it's really an inflammatory, the inflammatory response causes the heart attack, a lot of that comes from the folks who own the patent on the C-reactive protein trial. And I hope we'll get a chance later in the show to talk about the Jupiter trial, this big study that showed that people with low cholesterol but high marker of inflammation supposedly benefit from taking statins. But a lot of the information, the theory that heart attacks come from inflammation, comes from this research that's being done by the people who own the patent on the test and stand to make a profit every time the test is being done. So pardon those folks with hypertension, pardon my this little saying, but you got to take this with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I've been taking turmeric to try to keep that CRP level down. So, you know, again, I'm trying to get my homocysteine levels in check by taking, you know, the right supplements as well. I'm a big believer in that, John.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether trying to get the CRP level down is putting the cart before the horse, because the elevated CRP level, if it is elevated, may not be a risk factor. It may just be an indicator of a risk. In other words, studies have come out that claimed that C-reactive protein, high C-reactive protein, predicted increased risk of heart attack.
Right.
But
right.
If you control those studies, some of those studies weren't adequately adjusted for whether or not people smoked or not, or whether they were former smokers. And when you add that control in, you get the idea that the C-reactive protein may be monitoring the extra risk that people carry because they're current or former smokers. And in that case, treating the CRP wouldn't be helpful. The issue is stop smoking and stop smoking a long time ago.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this stuff gets off the main issue, which is if you exercise routinely and you eat a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, you're going to be doing so much more to prevent heart disease than all of these medical details put together. And as we talk about the science, which I love to do, I just don't want your listeners to forget that really the way to prevent heart disease is the natural things that our grandparents and great-grandparents told us, which is go out and exercise every day, eat a healthy, balanced diet, don't smoke cigarettes, and watch out for the stress in your life.
Absolutely.
And doing those things is going to cover about 80% of your risk of heart disease.
John, what's going on with the American Academy of Pediatrics recommending guidelines for testing cholesterol levels in children over the age of 2? Why? Aren't they too small for this?
Well, when we say aren't things getting better, this is a good example of what I think shows that things are not getting better. Last July 2008, in the journal Pediatrics, which is the journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, was published guidelines that recommended exactly what you just said, checking cholesterol levels in kids at risk from age 2 on, kids with a family history or obesity or hypertension from age 2 on, and treating kids with statins, cholesterol-lowering drugs, once they get to be 8 years old if they have high LDL and other risk factors. And the American Academy of Pediatric Experts say there's enough indirect scientific evidence to recommend this treatment. And you say, well, are there conflicts of interest? You know, were the experts getting paid by the drug companies? Now, listen to this. This is so shocking in 2008. The conflicts of interest were not declared in the article, and the editor of the journal said that they didn't need to write the conflicts of interest because they made sure that the experts were truly good at what they did. They vetted the experts. Now, this is craziness. We know that at least two of the experts do have financial ties to drug companies. We know that there are no long-term studies of safety of statins in kids. We know there are no long-term studies of clinical outcomes of any benefit in kids with a clinical outcome. And furthermore, when we look at the web page on the American Academy of Pediatrics that talks about its honor roll of corporate donors, it looks like something that Stephen Colbert made up to have us laugh. Because in the president's circle of corporate donors to the American Academy of Pediatrics is AstraZeneca, Merck, and Sanofi Aventis. They all make cholesterol-lowering statin drugs. And you're not going to believe this. In the president's circle of the American Academy of Pediatrics is also McDonald's with a little logo that says, "I'm loving it." So their corporate sponsors are going to bring the kids' cholesterol up, and they're going to feed them, a diet that's high in saturated fats, and then they're going to sell them drugs and bring it down.
All for money.
All for money. You know, I think you judge a society by how the society treats its weakest and most vulnerable people, which are usually children. And you look and see that we're doing this with statins for kids, with psychiatric drugs for kids is even a more outrageous story, with the attention deficit drugs for kids. You know, we've all become in this society, George, we've all become objects that were marketed to so our ingestion of drugs will make more money for the drug industry. And that's what's passed off as American healthcare.
John, as I mentioned, I'm into a lot of supplements and I do a lot of internet research. Now, is that doing the right thing? I mean, the example is, I'll study something on immune systems and I'll take supplements that many, primarily in China, in some of the ancient texts have written about, because I have a belief that they knew things far greater than we did.
Sure.
Is that okay to take things like that, these supplements? They're not going to hurt you, are they?
The answer is probably not, George. And we really don't know the answer because there isn't good enough science. And I think common sense and moderation is going to help make sure you're getting the supplements from responsible companies. You're not getting imported supplements that may be adulterated or contain foreign material. I think you got to use common sense. You're kind of on your own. But I want to go back to this issue. I hate to sound simplistic about this. I've spent thousands of hours looking at this science. And I want to come back to the fact that if you exercise and eat a healthy diet and don't smoke, those are by far the most important things you can do to prevent heart disease. And the drug industry wants to make you passive and think you need them and their blood tests to be better. And sometimes the supplement industry can be a little aggressive, too.
Sure. Well, what do you mean, though, by healthy diet? How do we know what that is?
Great question. The healthy diet, the easiest way to look at it is if it's generally unprocessed foods. Processing foods increases the profit that can be made on the food, but it adds things that are not natural. So a healthy diet on the positive side would have five servings of fruits and vegetables every day. It would rely largely on unrefined grains, so whole wheat and unrefined grains, brown rice. What you would be avoiding is animal fats and trans fats. So you would be avoiding the cream part of dairy, skim milk, 1% milk is fine, but butter and cream, you're avoiding red meats, you're avoiding fatty cheeses, and really important to avoid is trans fats. Trans fats are artificial. Our bodies don't know how to metabolize them. They actually increase the C-reactive protein level. If you divide people into 20% groups of how much trans fats they eat, the C-reactive protein levels are 73% higher in the group that ingests the most trans fats compared to the lowest trans fats. So you want to stay away from those trans fats. And in order to do that, you got to take out your reading glasses because you got to look at the label and you got to look for partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. partially hydrogenated safflower oil or palm oil or any partially hydrogenated oil is a trans fat, and those are very unhealthy for you.
Very good. Stay with us. Dr. John Abramson, our guest. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour. More to talk with him about. His website, overdosedamerica.com. And then later on tonight, psychic Joseph Jacobs joins us as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, what about the safety behind these drugs? Are we being protected there? I think not.
Not. You're correct. We just don't know about the safety of many of these drugs, including the cholesterol-lowering drugs. And what happens is the drugs are approved with very small tests that involve hundreds or sometimes 1,000 people. Usually a total of about 3,000 people have taken the drug before it's approved. And then suddenly, after the FDA approves the drug, millions of people are taking it. What happens is that the effect of the drug is not followed in a systematic way. So you would think that the FDA, whose job is to make sure that our drugs are safe, would be scanning, scouting what's happening out there to see if there are any signals that there are increased side effects with any of these classes of drugs. And we have quite the opposite. There's no organized system to find side effects. And what we see is that the drug companies themselves will often shelve studies, not publicize studies that do show safety problems. So this is a real issue. And another issue that's been raised by David Graham, who's a wonderful FDA officer inside the FDA who cares passionately about public safety, is that when these studies are done, even as small as they are for drug approval, in order for a drug to be deemed unsafe, it has to be found statistically significant, which means in order to be called unsafe, there needs to be a 95% certainty that it's unsafe, which makes no sense whatsoever. There should be a 95% certainty that it's effective.
Absolutely.
But there should be maybe a 50% certainty that it's unsafe before doctors and the public are made aware of a potentially serious problem. And we saw this with the Vioxx, the arthritis drug Vioxx and Dextra. Mm-hmm. They both got pulled from the market. There were strong clues that those drugs had serious problems. But the serious problems didn't quite reach statistical significance, and tens of thousands of Americans died because that safety alarm is set so high.
And said, give me some examples of a drug that was purportedly safe and effective, and then something happened, besides Vioxx.
Resulin is a good example. Resulin is a diabetes drug, or was a diabetes drug, that was, when I was in practice, I was a family doc for 20 years, and when I was in practice, it became the predominant theory that type 2 diabetes is caused because people's bodies become resistant to the effect of insulin, and the insulin doesn't work, and the blood sugar can't get into your cells, and then the blood sugar builds up, and you get diabetes. Well, the cure for insulin resistance just happened to be the very expensive new drug Resulin, which lowered blood sugar by sensitizing cells to insulin action. Well, it turned out that Resulin does do that, but it also caused fulminant liver failure and many deaths from liver failure, and it was pulled off the market long after it should have been. There were signs that it was trouble. In fact, Resulin was included in an NIH study after it was known that it caused liver damage, and that study continued to go on even after other countries had pulled Resulin from the market. And it turned out that there were financial relationships between the researchers at the NIH and the drug company that makes Resulin.
Take a few calls here while we continue to talk with you, John. Let's go to Keith in Alaska, west of the Rockies. Keith, go ahead, please.
Hello, George. Hello, my friend.
Hey, Keith.
How you guys doing?
We're good.
Great.
Good.
Can you see Russia from where you are?
Pardon me, sir?
Can you see Russia from where you are?
No.
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 We're in southeast Alaska. Maybe if I were over by Burrell with a telescope, I may be able to see him.
Okay.
My question for you, sir,
yep,
is what drugs, if any, has been approved by the FDA for cancer?
A good question. That's a very good question. There are a number of drugs for chemotherapy that are approved. And when a person has cancer, these are very difficult decisions. The key here is to have a cancer doctor who's willing to be open and honest about what the benefits of the therapy that's recommended are. In other words, if somebody has cancer and it hasn't spread, and it's a cancer that's sensitive to chemotherapy, it makes perfect sense to go ahead and do that chemotherapy and knock that cancer down, hopefully cure it, but knock it down and have a lot of good time to enjoy. Other times cancer has spread, it's not going to be cured, and then the question is not whether there's evidence that the drug might decrease the size of the cancer, whether there's evidence that the drug might benefit certain laboratory tests. What you want to know is that drug more likely than not to improve the quality of your life and let you enjoy the time that you have as much as possible? So, Keith, these are very hard questions. They're very complicated, and you got to trust an expert, but you got to find an expert who trusts you and respects you and is willing to talk to you.
Okay, Keith, thanks. Thank you, too. I've always believed, John, that all of us have cancer cells in our body. They just lie dormant for most of us.
And our immune systems pick them up and get rid of them. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And at some point, either because the mutation has created such an aggressive cell line or because our immune system, like in HIV would be the extreme example in AIDS, when our immune system isn't working, you see certain cancers come through because the immune system doesn't pick them up early.
Next up, let's go to Jared in Modesto, California. Hey, Jared, go ahead. You're on with Dr. John Abramson.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. I've had a question that I've wanted to ask for a long time. Several years ago, I was living in Omaha, and I happened to run into this guy who was working on this international patent to design the storage containers to hold the uranium rods that were going to go into this project in Yucca Mountain.
Okay.
And it just happened that my father worked for the Bechtel Corporation, who is in charge of that. And I gave this design to my dad, and he took it to his Corps of Engineers. They said they liked it, but the problem with it was it was a natural occurring product. Basically, what it was granite. They would put the uranium rods in it, seal it up, store it, and the cost was, significantly cheaper. They said the problem with it is that they have to have something synthetically made in order for it to be insured and in order for them to use it. And I've always kind of wondered if that's been the problem with, herbalistic healing, naturalistic healing versus taking drugs. I mean, do you have to take something synthetically made, something man-made? Because, as far as herbs and medicine, naturalistic healing, it's not really regulated. And are you following me?
Jared, I'm following you perfectly, and it's a brilliant comment. And I wasn't sure where you were going with the uranium, but you're absolutely right on. What happens in medicine is there are patents. In other words, you couldn't patent granite. You'd have to patent a synthetic container that would hold the radioactive waste. And in medicine, there are patents, and the patents tend to last around 7 years after a drug comes on the market. It's a little complicated, but approximately 7 years. And what happens is the drugs that are on patent, it means that the manufacturer has a monopoly, and they can make a lot of money by advertising that drug, pushing that drug into the marketplace. And what happens is two different kinds of remedies get pushed into the background. One is exactly as you've said, herbal or natural remedies that are not patentable, and the other remedies that get pushed into the background are the generic remedies that work just fine and cost a fraction as much. And the system of patents, along with the advertising that's allowed in the United States, and direct-to-consumer advertising is only allowed in the United States and New Zealand, no other countries allow it, creates this distortion where we think that the patented drugs are superior just because the marketing goes on when they're not at all. And the best example of that right now is the sleeping pills. There's been a 60% increase in the use of sleeping pills since 2000. It's not because the sleeping pills got better. It's because there's patents on these newer drugs like Lunesta and Ambien CR and so forth. There's patents on these drugs. So the drug companies can make a lot of money by advertising them and creating the illusion that they're superior. So people will go to the doctors and ask for them, and doctors will believe they're superior because they're getting the samples and the drug reps and so forth. And so it is this patent system combined with a marketing system that allows the distortion of the true science that creates exactly the same problem you're talking about in uranium storage. Great comment.
John, what is it about this planet that cures? For example, aspirin, willow bark. Mm-hmm. There just seems to be almost every pharmaceutical that has been a synthetic version of something natural. What is it about this planet that fights disease, that fights illnesses? It is truly amazing.
I think you come back, and we're going to leave science now, and I think it's important to leave science, George, and we're going to get into the metaphysics of spirituality or ecology or whatever you want to call it, holism. But we evolved in a balance with our environment. And much of our problem has to do with being out of balance with it. Much of our health problems have to do with being out of balance with our environment.
We're out of sync.
We're out of sync. And the environment has the products that are part of our body. And you're absolutely right that there is this ancient wisdom that we are losing. And it is this way that we live in sync with our external environment. And that natural wisdom has become like laughed at in medical school and by doctors who see themselves as scientists of the human machine. It's that natural wisdom that's lacking. In fact, that's the book I wanted to write. I was well into writing that book for medical students to help them understand that the person in front of them isn't just a machine, that we need to understand that they're a human being. And I backed into the information about Vioxx and realized people were getting killed and realized that I had to tell this story first. But I totally agree with your assumptions that if we sort of default to the natural, we're gonna get it right most of the time. And a good healthcare system would allow you to have a relationship with a doctor who understood that and then could coach you through what the benefits of medical science could provide in certain circumstances.
Let's go east of the Rockies, Battle Creek, Michigan. Kellogg's, the cereal, they're out there. Hey, Nita, go ahead. Hello? Nita, are you there?
I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Back in the 70s, we were told there was going to be a swine flu epidemic. I was working in the healthcare system at the time, and they said, since you take care of patients, you should take this shot. So I talked my husband into it. We lined up at Kmart, of all places, got the shot. My husband became immediately deathly ill. And I was under 30, and I thought I was working too hard. My joints just hurt terribly. I thought I was finally hospitalized. We got a letter from a year later from the government stating that we screwed up. This was never tested on human beings. You don't have to sue us. Just tell us what your symptoms are, and we will send you money. Well, we never did because we figured they messed us around once. They'll do it again. And later, years later, I looked it up on the computer, and it was awful. People were complaining of Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Absolutely.
Oh, it was awful. Terrible, terrible joint problems, which I have. My husband eventually, I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not, but he became diabetic. But right after the shot, his fever went to 105. He swelled up like a balloon. It was just awful. And then they had the nerve a year later to say, only swine get swine flu, humans don't. And that, you know, they screwed up and send us a letter and they'll pay you. Does the good doctor have any ideas on this or any more information on this? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Yeah, Nita, thanks so much for calling. I do have some ideas about it, and your description of the problem is absolutely right. To the best of my knowledge, there was one case of swine flu in the military, and it led to this massive vaccination program, and it absolutely did cause Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a hopefully temporary but sometimes permanent paralysis that comes from the spinal cord, from an inflammatory reaction in the spinal cord. So we had the swine flu debacle back in the 70s, the Secretary of Defense at that point was none other than Donald Rumsfeld.
Go figure.
Then he went to Searle and helped to get aspartame approved. This is the show that you did a couple weeks ago, Joe?
A couple months ago,
right. And, well, he was, Donald Rumsfeld was the CEO, I believe, of Gilead Scientific before he was called upon by President Bush to come back into the government to do another stint as defense secretary. And Gilead Scientific owned about 10% of the rights to Tamiflu. Well, after the Bush administration came in 2000, we started to hear about the bird flu risk, which it was a lot like the swine flu risk. The bird flu risk, bird flu is in birds. When people catch it from birds, it's a terrible disease, and there have been hundreds of fatalities. But the bird flu is not transmissible from person to person. And if it becomes transmissible, it's possible that it could. If it becomes transmissible, it would have to mutate, and we wouldn't know what kind of organism we were dealing with. Well, in that context of uncertainty, the government stockpiled enormous amounts of Tamiflu, and the drug company that made Tamiflu made a lot of money, and Gilead Scientific made a lot of money, and guess who was still owning a lot of his Gilead stock? None other than Donald Rumsfeld.
And he made a lot of money.
That's the allegation that's been in the press. So I think, Nita, you're right that the swine flu debacle was overzealous medical care without enough facts. And what we see is that when there's a profit to be made, that the overzealousness, the belief that we're doing the right thing, can get blown out of proportion when there's a profit to be made. And that's why it's so very hard as Americans to know what kind of health care, not throw out the baby with the bathwater, to know what the really effective health care is and get it, and to not get too much. I mean, I got an email. I was answering an email during one of the breaks that I got from a coast-to-coast listener, and he said he's had Lyme disease. He's been plagued with Lyme disease for 20 years. Now, this can be a real problem. And as well, there were laboratories that were producing non-reproducible results. And my response to him was, you know, you may need more medical care, not less. If you've really got Lyme disease and you've had it for 20 years, you need to go to an infectious disease specialist who's a super specialist in Lyme disease, because you may need months of intravenous antibiotics. So it's not that all medicine is bad, but the problem is that our beliefs about medicine and the knowledge that doctors have, this is the real problem, the knowledge that doctors have is produced and delivered to them because it's going to make money for the drug companies, not because it's going to improve our health. And how we sort that out is the challenge of the future in American medicine.
When we come back, we'll take more of your phone calls with Dr. John Abramson, and we'll also talk about manipulation, creating the fear to sell the drug. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Abramson with us. Your phone goes. John, manipulation then, when we're talking about the bird flu and the swine flu and all these other diseases, do they create the disease, in your opinion, exploit it, try to scare the heck out of us, and then come up with a vaccine to try to force all of us to buy it?
Well, sometimes. Bird flu is a good example, and I also want to talk about osteoporosis as a disease that was created to sell drugs. Bird flu was a real problem. The birds were getting sick, and human beings were getting it occasionally in Southeast Asia. And the United Nations begged for $175 million to pay farmers to kill their sick birds. None of that money was delivered. So we didn't do anything when we could have stopped this thing in its tracks. But when it started to become commercially advantageous, then the press got all over it, and we started to stockpile these very expensive drugs. So in that case, we didn't create the disease. The disease was there, but we didn't destroy the disease when we could have. We let it leak out and then brought in expensive and God knows whether they're effective or not solutions. Osteoporosis, the bone thinning in women, is a real interesting situation where suddenly half of women over the age of 52 were told that they had osteopenia or pre-osteoporosis, and half of women over the age of 72 suddenly had this disease called osteoporosis. And what it's a thinning of the bones. But what happened is that the drug companies or drug company-sponsored conferences defined osteoporosis in terms of the amount of calcium in a woman's bone compared to a young, healthy woman when her bones have peak mineral density. So they make this normal aging process a disease, come up with this statistical analysis where 50% of people over age 52 are going to be told they have a problem. So I was giving a lecture at the American, I think it was the American Association of Healthcare Journalists, and I was explaining this story that the conference, this is in the book, Overdosed America, I was explaining the story that the conference at which these definitions, these statistical definitions were made up to make women think they had a medical problem, were really sponsored by the drug industry, and you could trace it back to the drug industry. And the woman who spoke after me was a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who got a Pulitzer Prize for writing about this story. She said, well, Dr. Abramson got most of this story right. It did come out of this conference, and it was made up, and it's statistical. It's not a real disease. But the one thing he got wrong is the definition of osteoporosis didn't come out of that conference. It came from a bar napkin the night before the conference at a bar. That's where these guys thought it up.
Austin, Texas, we go. First-time caller. Diane, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a 46-year-old American vet, mother of 10. I have osteoarthritis. I have degenerative disc disease, bone spurs on my spine, nerve damage. And I've tried every natural way to get rid of the pain that there is, and because doctors will not prescribe me pain medication.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if doctors think it's, I guess it is more monetarily valuable to them not to prescribe me pain medicine. That way I'm not a burden on society, just on my kids and family, and my life is a living hell.
Yep. No, it sounds that way, Diane. Let's talk for a minute. What's the pain that's bothering you the most?
I've had three back injuries in my life, and all three of them hurt like hell.
And
my feet, and as a matter of fact, basically from my waist down, there's times that I go completely numb. I can't feel it.
Yep, yep. And have you tried taking what's called a tricyclic antidepressant like Elavil?
Oh, I'm taking antidepressants because of the massive depression that the pain puts you in.
Yep, no, but I'm asking a more specific question because the antidepressants that are most widely prescribed are a newer kind. It's a newer kind of drug, and it's those drugs are not effective for neuropathic pain, but the older antidepressants are effective for neuropathic pain. And this, too, is in Overdosed America, but doctors were convinced that these new antidepressants are so much more effective than the older antidepressants, but they're not. They're not. So write this down. Elavil, E-L-A-V-I-L. That's the brand name. It's now a generic, and it's not very expensive at all. But ask your doctor if you might switch over.
Could you spell that again? I'm sorry.
E-L-A-V-I-L, Elavil.
Okay.
The chemical name is amitriptyline, but that's you never know where the Y's go in that word, so just stick with Elavil. but ask your doctor if switching from the antidepressant you're currently on, and you'd have to taper down, and you'd want to do this with your doctor, and then going on Elavil and building up the dose, might be as effective. It is as effective as an antidepressant. Your doctor won't know that, but it is. And you might want to bring him my book and show him that it is. And that has the best odds of treating the pain that's coming out of your back without making you dopey, so that it's going to be harder for you to function and harder for your kids. So Elevil is what I would, if you came to me, that's what I would recommend. Now, these are very hard problems, Diane, and my heart goes out to you. You are one hard-working lady. You're a veteran, and you've got 10 kids. You're 46 years old, and you probably feel sometimes like you're 76. This is hard, tough stuff. I don't think that the doc is staying away from pain medicines for any financial reason. I think the doc is genuinely concerned that you'll be going down a street that you can't get back out of. And it's a risk. It's a risk. And I'd much...
You know, do I really care if I'm stuck in bed for the rest of my life?
Yeah, now that's no
good.
That's
what I'm looking at.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you. This is not okay. This is not okay.
It seems like, you know, they're acting like that all this is coming out of their pockets when I'm having to pay for my prescriptions.
No, it's not money. You know? It's not money. They may have an attitude that's not fair, but it's not money. That's not money. But I would say I would want you to try the Elevil and get up to a good dose of it. You got to go slowly because you'll get a dry mouth from it, and that scares away a lot of people. But I would build up slowly. And there's no question. I know a lot about this because this was in. It's part of a huge court case that I'm involved in about a drug called Neurontin. You've probably been on Neurontin as well, I assume.
Yeah. What do you think of medicinal marijuana, John?
Good question. I think that if people are in a medical situation where it's going to be beneficial, I don't see the harm. I mean, I think marijuana can be harmful when kids get it and they get psychologically messed up and they become psychologically dependent and they don't do their growing up and they tune out and they don't get their education. I think there are a lot of potential problems with marijuana. But I think if somebody, say somebody with terminal cancer, and marijuana caused them to feel better and have a better appetite, I don't have any problem with it. A lot of the drugs we're using are a lot more dangerous than marijuana.
We're going to Boston now. Joe is there. It's got to be the same Joe, right,
hey,
Joe?
Hey, George. How you doing? I haven't talked. Hey, Dr. John. Glad I got your email.
Hey, Joe. How are you doing?
Not too good. I know. I want to talk to you, and I want to have a question and a comment. I was on the Rotten, and I almost felt like ending my life, so I took myself off it. I'm so glad you're going into a court case about this. My friend who's an EMT, I'm going to send him a tape of this, had the same problem. I have been...
There's probably an article coming out in a major medical journal about this, so you'll have more. You'll be better armed. And the stuff, the judge unsealed the expert reports in this law case. It happens to be in a court in Boston, a federal court in Boston. The judge unsealed the expert report, so I can now talk about the secret corporate documents that I know about, that I wrote about in that report. And, Joe, this would just make you furious when you see what they did to cover up the negative studies about Neurontin, to mislead doctors. Let me just read you an email. I happen to have it up on my computer. Let me read you an email. They did studies about Neurontin for pain, and one study, they sort of jerry-rigged the study and got it to come out positive. And then a couple years later, they did another study that had three times more patients in it taking the drug, and it came out negative, and they never published the study. And let me just read you. This is the kind of stuff that you get in litigation. I'm going to read you a direct quote from a corporate email about hiding the results of the study called 224. This one drug company employee is writing to another. I think we can limit the potential downsides of the 224 study by delaying the publication for as long as possible and also from where it is published. More importantly, it will be important to how we write up the study. We are using a medical agency to put the paper together, which we will show to the lead investigator. We are not allowing him to write it up himself. Now, when you get in litigation, this is what you see going on behind closed doors, and the American people need to know that this is what's going on with their health care.
John, is there any criminality involved in any of this? Have you found that to ever happen? So they nail the company, they get sued, all right, some money comes out and flows. But does anybody ever go to jail for this?
Very rarely, George, and you hit the nail right on the head. With Vioxx, conservatively, 30,000 Americans died, 25,000 of them probably after Merck understood that it was a serious problem. And $10 billion of Vioxx was sold, and so far the legal settlements have been $4.8 billion. So if they put $1 billion into drug development and $1 billion into their legal fund and a few billion into marketing, they're still ahead of the game.
They ought to start putting these people away who knew what was happening within the companies on manslaughter charges.
Listen to this. Coast to Coast Nation, listen to this. Ray Gilmartin was the CEO of Merck. He came in 1994, and he left after Vioxx was withdrawn in 2004. The company was run down by Vioxx. The company should have pulled the plug on it a long time ago. He walked away with $180 million, and he went on college campus tour lecturing about business ethics.
Unbelievable. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Again, Jeanette, wildcard line. Hey, Jeanette.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I actually have a question. I just found out recently that I have a thyroid problem, probably had it since I was little. Now, I know that with – did I lose y'all?
No, I'm just listening.
And then I'm being a good doctor and listening and not interrupting.
Sorry. Well, I've also done some research on the medication and that I'm not to take carbohydrates with it because it blocks the absorption of it.
What, you mean just when you take the pill?
When I take the pill within an hour, if I'm going to eat, I have to wait 2 hours after I eat or wait an hour before after I take the pill.
And what is the pill, Synthroid or Thyroxin?
It's Thyroxin. It's the generic.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and the generic's fine. There's no reason to get the brand. And the question is?
Okay, we're going to move on, John. I've got so many people lining up for some other calls.
Okay, good.
I can't get you to prescribe things for people and things like that, obviously.
Okay.
Next up, let's go to Houston, Texas. Carla, you're on with us. Go ahead, Carla.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Back in 1993, I was given Indocin, which I understand is the precursor of Vioxx. And within 2.5 weeks, I had severe high blood pressure. Never had a history of that before. And there seemed to be no prescription treatment for it. I had already been heavily into alternative health, but this was the first life-threatening thing I'd faced. And I did try some prescription drugs through an alternative health practitioner, a complementary medicine person. And we couldn't find anything that would treat it. Either it didn't affect the high blood pressure and was causing congestive heart failure, or it set my blood pressure too low.
Mm-hmm.
So after about a year, they just said, you're on your own. You have to deal with this on your own. And I had it pretty well managed. After about 5 years, I got the blood pressure pretty well under control, unless I got a sudden shock.
Uh-huh.
And then over the last 2.5 years, I've had several life crises that have resulted in this coming back. Evidently, the best we've been able to piece together is that somehow this damaged the buffers on the endocrine glands and especially the adrenal glands.
Mm-hmm.
And if I get this sudden shock, my blood pressure just shoots out the ceiling in like 2 seconds up to potential stroke levels. And nothing seems to be able to control it. And then if it goes on for long periods of time, then my adrenals crash, my blood pressure goes out the bottom, and my immune system craters.
All right. How about a question here, Carla?
Yeah.
Well, I get the drift, Carla. One thing that you might want to try, you probably have, but if you're coming, I would think you should ask your doctor about a beta blocker. And the reason why I say a beta blocker, it's a pretty good blood pressure medicine, not the best, but it might prevent the that sympathetic nervous system, that fight or flight response when you get an emotional shock that your body can't handle anymore. The beta blocker might buffer the neurological response to the shock.
Tomorrow morning, people wake up, John. What do they do to begin to start changing their lives?
Number one is start exercising. You know, make sure that
even after that's walking around the block, right?
At a brisk pace. But as long as you're huffing and puffing for a half hour, 3 to 5 times a week, you get credit.
And start slow, right?
Start slow. Don't get injured. And the best kind of exercise is the kind you enjoy, because that's the kind you'll keep doing. Whether it's a game, whether it's playing with the dog, whether it's walking with the neighbor, whether it's going to the gym or playing with your kids, just get out and exercise. So stop being passive and get out and exercise. Number two, don't be a sucker and eat junk food. You're making money for someone else, and they're hurting your body. Take control of what you put in your mouth. Number three, don't listen to those drug ads. They're trying to make you sick. They're trying to make you need stuff. And take your health in your own hands. 70% of your health is in your own hands. And that's the most important message, George.
I like at the end of these drug ads, they say, and if you take it, your ears will fall off, your eyes will fall off, your toes will fall off.
Right. You know. Well, I was getting ready for the show tonight, and I turned on the TV to relax a little, get a little nap, because I'm on the East Coast, and it's late. So I know one of the issues that you folks have been interested in is the anti-smoking drug Chantix. And it's had some side effects, and it's all not all that effective, and we can talk about it if we have time. But I saw an ad by Pfizer, which is the maker of that drug. They never mentioned the drug's name. They just said, if you're trying to quit smoking, talk to your doctor because there's help available. And when they don't mention the drug name, they don't have to say that there are serious psychiatric side effects to the drug. And
Let the old doc make up his mind, right?
Let the old doc make up his mind, but it's a way to advertise and get around having to say there are potentially serious problems with this drug, folks.
Man, unbelievable. Is the book still out there, Overdosed America?
Out there. It was reissued about a year ago and updated. There's a PS edition, and it brings up the statins up to date, and it brings up the litigation and Vioxx up to date. And that book is wearing well. I lecture all over the country to doctors, and there's nothing in that book out of date. And unfortunately, doctors aren't getting – I got invited to do grand rounds at a community hospital about an hour north of me about a week ago. And the guy's a real nice guy, and he's an editor of a medical journal, actually. And then he wrote me the next day, and he said, there's an article in the New York Times, and it shows that the best blood pressure medicine is the cheapest. We were talking about this at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And this study came out about 6 years ago, and nobody's paying attention to it. And what do you know about that? And I wrote him back, and I said, I'm both proud and sad to say, Carl, that study is in my book, which was written 4 years ago, that doctors aren't prescribing the right blood pressure medicine, and nobody's listened.
Overdosed America, Dr. John Abramson. Thanks, John.